Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the program. Between now and nine, calves in jackets in Cork, plucking strings in Sligo, waiting on acres checks in Limerick and Mayo, and silence at the movies in Galway. Well, that bit brighter now at 8 a.m. tells you that the drumbeat of the seasons is marching on, and here we are in the second half of February already, and there are over 500,000 spring calves born already this year. It struck us when we were talking about how to cover calving on the programme this year that in a relatively short number of years, a huge amount of change has happened around calving. Sexed semen, dairy to beef calves, changed movement rules, changes which, if you're not in the dairy industry or a dairy farmer, can be hard to see the wood from the trees on, but they do add up. To what, though? So, stay with us this morning. If you drink milk, if you don't approve of drinking milk, if you eat cheese or yogurt or butter, or if you don't, it is time for a little bit of a stock take. Professor Frank O'Mara, head of Chagas, will be here in a few minutes to look at how the life of the calf born in 2025 is different to the one born in 2005 and how different it might be in another 10 years. But I thought that it might be useful first to visit a vet slash dairy farmer, someone who understands what the gold standard of animal husbandry needs to be, but someone who also knows what it's like trying to calve and to milk and to spread slurry and to check grass and everything else all at the same time. Hazel Mullins is head of Veterinary Ireland and milks 60 cows with her father, in Carrignavar, north of Cork City.
They're all the boys and girls from last year.
Look at you.
So there's 8 calves in here now at the moment with their jackets on and lots of straw. And then we have the automatic feeder, which was only turned on yesterday. So we're still all getting used to it.
How is the automatic feeder working out then?
It's good, yeah. There's a screen here that I can check to see which calves have fed today. So it's all very scientific. So see all those green ticks next to each calf here? Mm-hmm. So that means that they've all fed in this 8-hour period. So there's one calf here, 5:12. So by 4 o'clock, she should have drunk. So I'll find her and just lead her up to the feeder so she makes sure she feeds.
But okay, that exclamation mark means that she hasn't had anything or just not enough?
She hasn't had her allocated 2 litres in this 8-hour period. And maybe we could go find 15:12 and she might feed for us as well. She's my husband's favourite calf, actually, because she's got that character.
Yeah, she doesn't do what you ask her to do.
No, it's a bit like... Oh, now...
There she is.
So as you can see, the green light has gone on. So she'll start
see,
sucking
you,
there
you
now.
You wanted to feed. Look at that.
Yeah. So the milk is going from the main station through the pipes into the feeding station. And the green light is on. And that machine knows that this is 15:12 because there's a reader in the side of it there and her ear tag is electronic. So it reads it and they know that will give information back to the machine that says that 15:12 has drunk her 2 litres once she's finished. Yeah.
The automatic feeder replaces just 2 feeds at either end of the day, administered by hand by a tired and busy farmer, with a calf-specific size of feed of antibody-enhancing colostrum at more regular intervals. And in another innovation, the quality of the colostrum is now assessed on the farm by Hazel.
So this is the refractometer. So we would take a little drop of the colostrum and put it onto the little glass thing here and then close it down. And then you'd look up into the light and basically where the blue line meets the white line is what percentage proteins are in the colostrum, so over 22%.
Let me have a look.
Yeah, yes.
And the number scores so up the side, and
exactly.
You want that to be
22 or above.
Mm-hmm. If it's not?
If it's not, I'd probably go into frost better colostrum. To be fair, a lot of them are kind of reading 25, 26, at the moment, so I'm
so
kind
it's
of
not a problem. Okay.
Not a problem on the farm, but generally it is good to keep an eye on it, because if you're feeding poor quality colostrum, even if you're feeding the 3 litres, they're not going to be getting the benefit of it.
But my God, that's a level of science and inspection of what's going into these calves that is a million miles away from presumably the dairy farm that you grew up on.
Yeah, no, we definitely didn't have refractometers on the farm, or we weren't storing colostrum or anything like that. And now it seems just second nature, to be honest. And you get into a routine of it.
Do you see it in the calves?
I definitely feel like disease is less. I feel like there's less scour and there's less pneumonia. I think my dad has always been a really good stockman, so he's always had really nice calves, and we've always looked after our calves and had lots of straw and fed them really well.
But you get the benefit as well of being a vet, of seeing an awful
yes.
lot of other yards. So are
yeah.
they a different creature now, a different beast to the calf of 20, 30 years ago, do you think?
I feel like genetics as well have come on a lot, and I think that they're a healthier calf, and I feel like disease on farm, if it does come in, we can get on top of it. That is a big change since I qualified anyway 10 years ago. You know, there's a real intervention now. If there's something wrong on a farm, we can really do a lot. You know, there's a lot more tools in our toolbox, I feel. So these are the far-off cows that are maybe a couple of weeks from calving, and then these are hopefully all going to be calved in the next 2 weeks. And then the ladies with the pink on their backs, they're all calved, they're all milking.
The part of calving most non-farming people listening to Countrywide have a problem with is taking the calves away from the mother after they're born. Wearing both your dairy farmer hat and your vet hat, is there any noise in your head over that, or are you happy with it?
Removing the calf at birth, I'm knowing that they're getting their 3 litres of colostrum. It's giving them that calf the best chance for disease prevention later on in their lives. Also, dairy cows produce so much milk that one calf wouldn't be able to, you know, drink, and they'd be able to, they could get mastitis. Some cows have very little interest in their calves. Some cows are going off eating silage the minute they give birth, or once they go into the parlour, they kind of get their nuts and they get used to, they're back in their herd, they get back into routine. They're very, you know, they're content. Okay. And then they get back into their shed or out to the field.
So any distress is short-lived?
Very short, yes, yeah. If I was a calf, I wouldn't mind being in that calf shed. They're very cosy, they've got food on tap, and they're in their little jackets, and they're happy out.
You have jackets on most of them, and you have pink jackets and blue jackets.
Yes.
Have you really gone bougie or shishy enough to sex the jackets?
I might have, Philip. Yeah, the boys prefer the blue, I think. But they sometimes the boys do get the pink. But generally, I use it as a kind of an identifier as well. And
oh, that's what it is, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's not playing dress up with your calves, no?
No, not at all. Not at all. But look how cute they are. They're gorgeous.
Redeem yourself here, because there's the sort of the reptilian part of my brain says, oh, come on, 30, 40 years ago, calves never needed jackets. How much better do they do with the jackets?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of research on, I suppose, heat and warmth in calves. So calves have a critical temperature of 15 degrees. So basically that means anything less than 15 degrees, so it's probably about 9 degrees here now today, they're actually using energy to stay warm. So straw helps them to keep warm, extra feed helps them, and the jackets help them as well. So look, this isn't the warmest shed in the world, so I like to have the jackets on, especially for the first 2 weeks, because as they grow, their critical temperature, you know, lowers. So at 3 weeks, it's about 1 degree, 2 degrees. So they're much more able to cope with that temperature change. Yeah.
So the jury might be out on the pink and the blue, but as to the actual jacket,
there.
The thrive that these animals will experience as a consequence is just absolutely accepted.
Yes, no, definitely. And I've noticed that, God, when you take off the jackets, like they've just, you don't realise how much they've thrived over the last couple of weeks, and it really shows in them. And I just think, look, they love them. They jump around in them. They don't mind wearing them. And it's just when you put your hand underneath the jacket, you can feel the warmth, and it's really nice.
Hello, hello. Yes, I'm going to do that. Oh, you're very cosy under there, aren't you? When were jackets introduced?
I would have said I would have seen them on farms. from about 5 years, they've gone really, really popular. Yeah. Okay.
So it really is a very recent innovation then.
Yeah, so we started off with maybe 10, and we've definitely, like, buying about 10, and then we went up, we've probably about 30 or 40 jackets now. Again, washing them is important because you need to keep them clean, and between calves you need to wash them. And yeah, so the gates outside in when it's a sunny day will be covered in calf jackets drying. So we'll get you down to wash a few calf jackets someday, Philip. And
that's quite all right. I don't know why you think I'd be qualified to do that. Hazel Mullins on the farm in Carrignavar. A lot of change from a welfare and a disease point of view there. But there are other issues to consider as well. Not least in recent years, the number of bull calves being slaughtered at or close to birth, because it's really only the female calf that can have a future in the milking parlour. So to paint a picture of the calf of 2025, I'm joined by Professor Frank O'Mara, Director General of Chagas, to look at what all of these changes of recent years have added up to. Good morning, you're very welcome, Frank.
Good morning.
The calves born on the Irish dairy farm this spring, the class of 25, if we can call them that, how different are they to the class of 15 or the class of 05?
Look, they're quite different. I think we're seeing a revolution going on dairy calf breeding and rearing on our farms over the last decade. First thing, I suppose, if you're a calf born now, you're probably going to be born into a place where you're going to be, you know, the care will have improved over that time, and we've heard Hazel doing fantastic job there in terms of the care of her calves. Your mortality risk is going to be lower now than it would have been even a decade ago. You know, when we look at the mortality at 28 days, in other words, how many of our calves will have died over that period, which is the high risk period, that has gone down from about 4% a decade ago to about 3% now. And, you know, the 4% was a low figure, but the 3% is a really, really good figure.
How does it compare internationally?
It would be lower. It's very hard to get good statistics. We actually have really good statistics here in Ireland on our calves, because every calf has to be registered at birth. And whether it's a dead calf or not, you know, that we have to track all those. So we have very good statistics, and not every country would do it the same way. So it's hard to get comparable figures. But we know that our figures would be, you know, as good as you would get.
I suppose there's a practical reason here as well, not just about animal husbandry, but a sick calf is a serious time suck for any farmer, isn't it?
Absolutely. Look, I suppose, you know, if you think of a dairy calf and you compare that maybe to a maternity hospital, you know, you're going to have a lot of births going on in both. But on a dairy farm, they're going to be concentrated over a 6 to 8 week period. And so you can imagine the job that there is in terms of birthing calves over that time. And then you've got the nursery as well, because you've got to keep those calves for, you know, 2, maybe 3 weeks at least. And so there's a huge job of minding calves then on a dairy farm at a time when you're also starting to milk your cows and trying to get your cows out to grass. So the big time drain on rearing calves is when they're sick. You know, if you can feed a lot of calves quite quickly once they're all healthy. But if you have, you know, a number of those that won't drink or are sick or whatever, and you're in minding individual calves, that's where it becomes a huge workload issue for farmers.
Sexed semen has been given a big push in the last couple of years to reduce the number of unwanted male calves. What has the uptake been like, Frank?
So the sex semen is, you know, really behind this quite revolution, or at least one of the key components of it. And it's all about ensuring that you can control the sex of the animal. And if you're on a dairy, if you're running a dairy herd, obviously you're going to need new dairy cows coming along every year. Somewhere around 20% of your herd is replaced annually. So with conventional breeding, if you want to breed 20 new female cows or calves, well, you're going to get 20, you know, male calves, which are really a dairy breed, which aren't really great for beef production. So if we can control the sex, and instead of breeding 40 animals to get 20 females, we can breed maybe 22 or 23 animals to get 20 females. You've eliminated those lower value calves, because they're not, you know, they're male, so they're no good for milk production. They're not bred for beef, so they're these lower value calves.
Okay. So the 1.5 million or whatever it is calves that are going to be born this spring now, how many of them will have been conceived through sexed semen straws?
So last year we used about 300,000 straws laws for sex semen. That's up from, you know, about 80,000 three or four years ago. So the conception rate is somewhere around, you know, 50 to 60%. So, you know, you're going to have somewhere 150, 180 calves born from sex semen. So when we look at it, the outcome from the beef, the male calf point of view, we're probably going to have 140,000 less male dairy calves born, you know, a dairy father and a dairy mother, but 140,000 less of those born this year than we had 4 years ago.
I think one of the interesting things about the uptake of sex semen was that it was done partly in response to consumer concerns about the dairy industry, which the industry then said, right, we have to address this really quickly. And as you say, we have seen in three or four short years, massive, massive uptake because the industry got behind it. Does the industry need to get behind the other innovations in this area that aren't so immediately profitable?
Well, look, I think you're 100% right. The whole of industry got behind this, you know, the AI industry, Chagas, ICBF and so on. And we saw great uptake. And, you know, that has been, I think, one of the success stories in Ireland and compared to maybe some other countries is that the number of unwanted calves that are slaughtered at birth has fallen. It was never very high and it has fallen and will fall again this year. We expect it to very low levels.
What I'm comparing this to is one of your colleagues in Chagask has developed a breeding program to reduce methane in cattle through the selection of certain straws. But you don't see industry giving that the same push as they did to sex semen.
I think that's breeding like that is a long-term game. You know, sex semen, you see the results immediately. You use a sex straw in your animals this May or June and you're going to see the result the following February. Breeding is a 10-year goal. So, you know, I think the breeding indices are much more aware of the factors that will contribute to lower methane or indeed lower overall greenhouse gas emissions. The primary thing that farmers can do in terms of breeding animals to have lower emissions is to breed more efficient animals and then to rear them better. And I think that's where the real push needs to come. And certainly the breeding of the future is going to be aware and take account of the carbon of the animals. That's what's in the indexes at the moment even.
One of the interesting things that's happened this year is that we have seen prices improve. Those stories of calves being sold for a fiver or being left behind at the mart have kind of disappeared because there's so much better a price being paid, probably in the UK. I wonder, though, if there is a financial incentive for keeping calves in Ireland, for bringing them on to maturity, is there a knock-on emissions, a problem with emissions there that we're keeping more animals on the island for longer?
So, look, you're right. The price of beef at the moment is at levels that we've never seen before, up around €7 a kilo. And that is translating back down to the price and the value of calves that are either being sold from farm to farm or through the marts.
And is that because of demand in the UK, do you think?
It's demand. Like, the UK is our biggest single market for beef. Europe is also a huge market. The two of those are really where the vast majority of our beef goes. And in both of those markets, the price of beef is very strong. And that's because production of beef in the UK and in Europe is dropping. Indeed, we see in Ireland our own herd is dropping as well. You know, we've 100,000 less calves born in 2024 than we had in 2022.
Okay, so this is people exiting the suckler sector.
Yes.
But there are increased numbers moving in partially to fill that vacuum, are there?
Well, the number of people exiting the suckler sector was quite big the last 2 years, and that there wasn't a compensating increase in dairy cow numbers. So overall, the number of calves born last year, as I said, was about 100,000 lower than 2 years ago. So we see the dairy herd, it actually shrank a little bit last year as well. You know, so our dairy herd is probably relatively stable. We would hope that the suckler herd would stabilise now because it has dropped quite rapidly over the last couple of years.
And are you confident that in the breeding and that in the other innovations we're going to be able to reach that 25% emissions reduction target rather than having to reduce the size of the herd?
Well, we've always looked for ways to improve the system and to bring in new technologies to fight to reach that 25% target without the need for any kind of an enforced or incentivised call of the herd. We would have...
But at the moment, as it stands, we're at 3% of that target at the moment, yeah?
We're at about 3% lower now in 2023 than we were in 2018.
Years to go.
No, there's a bit more. 2023, there's still 7 years to go to 2030. So, and we think 2024 will be further down, and hopefully we will continue that. So, look, we still have a huge job to do to get that 25% target. Farmers are working hard to get there.
Professor Frank O'Mara of Tagus, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We're going to the movies after this break.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
The late, great Charlie Chaplin made 81 films. Only 7 of them, though, were in sound, as he was dead against the talkies for much of his acting career. Silent cinema, though, has made a resurgence in Galway, where founder and director Adam Scheffler hosts weekly screenings and has plans to take Laurel and Hardy, Chaplin, Buster Keating and other classics out to summer festivals in rural areas. Lorna Siggins joined a Saturday night audience for Countrywide in an upstairs wine bar called Cinema in Galway's Dominic Street.
We are always screening our silent films with live piano accompaniment. So please welcome Mila Maya on the piano.
That's the voice of Adam Scheffler, founder of Galway's Silent Cinema, and he is introducing a screening of Italian director Guido Brignoni's 1925 classic Machista in Hell.
It's a fantasy horror. It's just crazy special effects. I have no idea how they managed to do it in 1925, but they did it, so that makes this film even better in my eyes. Please enjoy, and thank you for coming.
Adam has a panel of musicians for his silent cinema, including Desiree Odua, Thomas Quill, Augustina Taborda and Mila Maya playing tonight.
So usually I come up with a theme, for example. Like a dramatic part or a mysterious part, or just go, I follow the scene. Just try to follow what's going on. For example, if something falls, I would do like a something like that, or and I try to match it together with the scene, so you need to know very well when it's going to happen to match it.
So the talkies show up in the 1928-29. People look at silent films as something primitive, but for me personally, silent films are completely different film art. Silent films were never silent, you know, they were always with the accompaniment of the music. If you have great artists doing that, it's like being at the cinema and attending concert, music concert at the same time. Around 10,000 films of different kind were made at the beginning of cinematography. Only not even 10% survived.
Really? It's because of film archivists that we have these.
Yes, but you know, many of really great films were found just completely by accident. Even Metropolis, all the big titles, all the amazing films, they were found somewhere at the attic of some old house, somewhere in Brazil.
How did you start this up then?
You know, it all started 2 years ago. I thought about the silent films, like silent cinema, from really long time. I knew that it will not be as popular as just regular cinemas. It will not make enough money to stay open 7 days a week. I spent some time in Berlin. And Berlin in the 1920s was like in the epicenter of silent films, burlesque clubs, the Roaring Twenties, you know. And I've seen in Berlin clubs which are not even bigger than this place. I think that the moment when I thought about silent cinema, when I seen Nosferatu in Babylon Theater with the orchestra, you know, so I really had the goosebumps watching that with all these musicians, you know.
Are there some films that some are more difficult than others?
Yeah, comedy.
Is comedy more difficult?
Yeah, because you have to get the timing of the comedy.
Oh, you know, if you miss it, you ruin it.
Especially when it comes to the slapstick, you know, where you have this slip on the banana, you know.
Something hit in like face. Or, so you have to be, to get ready for that. So you kind of have to watch the movie more times to memorize where it happens, how it happens. And
so that you're anticipating this, and you've got your eye on the screen,
as well as on the keyboard. So it's tricky. And usually, like live, you know, up tempo music all the time, so it's hard to keep up, like for, you know, more than an hour.
So Laurel and Hardy is more difficult, say,
definitely than dramas, and so that's definitely harder.
And it's upbeat all the time.
Exactly. So when it's like a drama or romantic movie,
you can't make any pause during, you know, screening.
Like romantic movies or drama, or it's just easier to create some moments and, you know, harmonies that will work really well, but you can breathe a bit more. But I love doing it.
Lorna Siggins reporting there. Silentcinema.ie for more details. ACRES is the current agri-environmental scheme which rewards farmers for their work protecting nature on their lands. It's different to previous schemes because it is results-based. The better your environmental incomes, the higher your score. The higher your score, the bigger your payment. And while the scheme is delivering in many aspects, some farmers are experiencing improbably long delays in getting the payments that are due to them, over 2 years in some cases. And this morning I am joined by a number of them to explain the work that they've been doing in this scheme and the impact that these delays are having on their farming enterprise. So good morning, Tim McCraith, Colleen Keneally and Anthony Walsh. Anthony, can I begin with you, please? Cross Malina, County Mayo, sheep and beef farm. Why did you get into ACRES in the first place?
I'm the second generation, Philippa, of farmer in this particular area, and I feel so passionately, and I love the land. We don't sell it, we hand it on as good or better than we get it. So this is a means that the government provides us with funds just to survive, to implement what the environment badly needs.
Okay.
And we do that.
So it was one part environmental and one part financial, is what you're saying to me.
Absolutely. And the incentive to be so environmentally conscious is the reward of the money that we desperately need. Now, I entered into that in 2023, and at a huge expense. This isn't something that we enter into.
What was the outlay?
Easily. We have to change our farming practice completely. We can't feed or poach the land. So that entails taking in the livestock, a lot of them, for the winter. Once you take in livestock into the sheds, you automatically change your system because you have to feed them with concentrates. The concentrates aren't produced locally, and since the war, they have more than doubled in price. Now, I have bills at the local merchant just up the road from me, and I am so fortunate. I have a year and a half of credit with that man. I have credit built up with the local vet. I have credit built up with the pharmacist in Cross Malina. And they're not plaguing me for money. I am fortunate. But can you imagine what it's like to go into church in the morning once a week, and you dress up and sure you look wonderful, and you look across at those people, and the first thing that you say before you might stroll up to communion, I haven't paid those damn people. And look at the cut of me now.
So, what does that do to your sense of self, your sense of your standing in your own community, Anthony?
I'm fortunate. I am very fortunate because I am generally a happy person. But I'm so conscious of the people that isn't able to speak. And those people, what it's doing to them. Now, when they're waking up in the morning and they think of the people they haven't paid, and then they go into society, and then you start noticing those people not being as visible as they were. Now, we have health and safety checks on the land. They come, and it's good, and they check your PTO drives, and that we're conscious of firm safety.
But do they check your mental health?
Are they checking our mental health? No. Nobody will come to see what we're like, but I can assure you, if this continues with the mental torture they're putting regular, ordinary people through, the dignitaries will dock up, but it'll be too late, because they'll be paying their respects.
A technical, boring kind of question, Anthony. Are you absolutely confident that there's no paperwork missing at your end, that you have dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's?
Well, you see, I wouldn't be confident in saying that, but I am so fortunate that I have a really grounded planner. And he is an expertise in this.
And he says you have.
Staff, and he can console me, and he can take and show me on his screen. I have sent this to Port Leash.
Okay.
But in the BIS department. But he can be quite confident that is it going to Wexford? Is the two sectors receiving from each other? And it's evident they're not.
Okay, let me bring in Tim McCraith here, Anthony. You're part-time beef farming in Garry Spillane in East Limerick. Tim, why did you get into Acres?
Well, I'm a beef farmer, just like the previous speaker there, and we did it for the income. We haven't the same income as a dairy farmer. And as like the other man there, we love our land and we care for it. It means an awful lot to us. But as I say, it's the income. You know, we just don't have the same income as a dairy farmer and we need the money. So we do this thing. This thing was hailed as a flagship environmental scheme. We went into it in good faith. And now we seem to be left here in the lurch.
How
now,
in the lurch,
ring
Tim?
But where this thing is being administered by, and they want even return phone calls there.
How
so
in the lurch are you, Tim?
And we're left carrying the can for the department's incompetence on this. We've done our bit, and we want to get paid.
And how much are you owed, Tim?
I'm owed over 8,000 as it stands at the moment, and it'll be over 11 now by May.
Which doesn't sound like a huge sum of money, but it's pretty critical to a small beef operation.
Well, it is for us beef farmers because we're not in the same sense like other farmers, and the same with people in the west of Ireland and sheep as well. Like I'm fortunate in some respects. I work outside the farm, otherwise I wouldn't be able to survive at all.
And Tim, can I ask you a personal question? Are you leaving bills unpaid as well, like Anthony?
Well, yeah, leaving bills unpaid and making the best of it. It's very frustrating. I mean, I know the people like there though that probably wouldn't come on the radio programme in the same position that they're embarrassed by not being able to pay their bills. We're all very proud people. We've been reared that way. I've been reared that way. Pay as you go, you know, or nothing to nobody. You know, I mean, it's the same for anybody. You know, look, we all signed up now to a farmer's charter with the department, and that means that we'll be paid on time.
And basically, you're saying it's a contract that the department hasn't kept up its end
with
of.
The department, and we have kept our end of the bargain, and they haven't kept theirs. Now, I listened the other day now to the department, Minister for Agriculture, and I was taken aback by him, and he said this thing is going to take weeks and months for this backlog. You know, I mean, we have done our bit. All my paperwork is intact. I have an agricultural advisor, Mike Ryan, and he's second to none. Everything's scorecards, everything is A1.
Well, let me bring in Colleen Keneally in Roundstone in County Galway, sheep and beef farmer. Colleen, similarly, are you satisfied? Are you happy? Is your advisor telling you that all of your paperwork is in order?
Good morning, Philip. Yes, Philip, all my paperwork is in order. I'm the Hill sheep, I'm the Hill farm rep for IFA. We met the department last December and they told us that it would be the end of January there'd be a cohort of farmers would be available in due to an IT problem on their system. So look, we waited for that the end of January. We're now near the end of February. Hasn't come and no correspondence of what is happening.
Okay, and how out of pocket are you, Colleen?
Out of pocket, 6,000.
And in an operation like yours, what does that mean?
Well, we're hill farm. Our land is tougher. Our environment is tougher. Everything's bought in: feed, fertilizer, bales. So it's all cost every day. And like, you're going into springtime now, and you've cows, calf, and ewes, lambing, and they've had a tough winter up in the hills. So there is a big cost there ahead of farmers, and that money has to come, like, to get the spring going.
And are you, like Tim, like Anthony, going around cap in hand to the co-op and to your various suppliers and saying, can you extend that line of credit, please?
Yeah, and we're lucky we have that. A lot of people we deal with, they're family-owned businesses, so they know you for generations. Yeah, and they've been very good to us. But, you know, if you're owed money by your departments, you know, it's our money, yeah, and we need to get that paid. It's just not fair.
I have the same question, I think, for all of you. Anthony, I'm wondering, I'll start with you first, please. If another environmental scheme was to be announced tomorrow, something like, we know there's going to be one ultimately for farming carbon, would you be inclined to sign up, or would you say, no, I'm going to leave that to other people?
I have given that serious thought, and I'd ask you and all your wonderful listeners, had you done work of a contract for entering into the third year and the person you were working for didn't pay you? Now, I would have serious reservations. If this money has come from the EU to our Irish government, what are they doing with it? Would you believe this? I have in front of me a department receipt that I received on the 25th of the 3rd, 2023, a payment to me of €5,637.95. And they took it out again the same day they paid it in.
Because it was an overpayment?
No, they took out the very same money they put in the same day they took it out. They paid it into my account and they took it out the same day. Now,
with an explanation, Anthony?
But sure, they won't answer the phone. No human being, this is the thing, I cannot speak to anybody. And when somebody won't talk to you, if I wasn't able to speak in the community, where would I go? And to my planner. My planner is the only one that's keeping me standing. Because he reassures me, it's not my fault. If it wasn't for Liam Welch, I don't know what I'd do.
Well, we can hear the stress in your voice there, Anthony. I assume, Tim, Colleen, yes or a no answer to that question. Would you get involved in an environmental scheme in the future, Tim?
Well, there's two answers to that. I completely agree with Anthony. Like, you'll have to think seriously about it. But the second answer is that we need this income. We don't have the income of the dairy farmer.
Okay. Colleen,
we have no choice.
What about you?
That's the downside of it, yeah.
Yes, look. Yeah, the income is needed on a farm, a hill farm in the west of Ireland. That income is very important. And farmers are committed to the environment. We've seen there in acres, 55,000 farmers almost in the scheme. They have delivered. They've bought into the scheme. And
but you have no choice than when these schemes come along to sign up to them. All right. Colleen Keneally, Anthony Walsh and Tim McCraith, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. We did put in a request for an update to the Department of Agriculture, but we're still waiting a response there. How many crematoriums are there in Ireland? Well, a lot less than there are graveyards, but 6 is the answer. But none of them in Connacht, at least until the end of March, when one is going to open in Killooney, County Sligo. Now, you may know the man behind it, David McGowan, made famous by the award-winning Netflix documentary The Funeral Director. But helping him is his daughter, Brigine, who is one of only a handful of female undertakers and embalmers in the country. Brigine has many strings to her bow, pun intended, because she is also a well-known musician and contemporary harpist. Brenda Donoghue met Brigine at the site of the new crematorium in Sligo.
So we're here now in the entrance here. We're very close. We are working away. Lots of people working here.
Hello.
Trying to get
the
job
you've got
done.
The building. Now, I'll take you in here into the service room.
Okay.
How long has your family been planning this?
We've been dreaming about opening a crematorium for years.
it all came down to the location, I suppose. We had looked at different sites around the place, but actually the planning officers had said they wanted it to be in an industrial zone. So any airy fairy field that we thought was lovely, they didn't like. So we said, well, we already have a space in an industrial zone, and let's just put loads of money into making that look amazing. The reason why this space and crematorium is needed so badly is because there's none in Connacht. We actually in Sligo and Mayo and Donegal, whatever, we have to drive 2.5 to 3 hours to get to a crematorium. So like you drove down from Dublin today, imagine us doing that same trek after a funeral service and going through all those motions and being so, you could be so traumatized and everything. And to be
It's exhausting.
Yeah. So we're so excited to have this space for our people. So I'm going to take you in here now. Okay. This is where the actual cremator is. You're not afraid of that, are you?
Let's have a look.
Again, with the nice light and the nice colour. Oh, Dad.
How are you, David? Are you well?
Stressed.
Stressed.
My anxiety levels now has gone through the roof.
Okay.
And any of the listeners that are doing any sort of development today in Ireland will know exactly how I feel. Watch yourself there, be careful. You wouldn't want to end up in the retort now. That's what they refer to, the cremator, is a retort.
This is a cremator I'm looking at.
This is actually the robot that will take you into the cremator.
Wow.
That goes into the retort. And this robot here takes the coffin and it places the coffin within in that nice and gently without it being disturbed or pushed or whatever.
How much is a cremator?
Well, you wouldn't have much change out of $500,000 now for that particular machine. Yeah. But that's not including all the construction works and all the work that comes along with it. So you're looking at about an investment of about $1.6 million.
And you must see the need for it, though.
Well, look, I wouldn't do it and spend that sort of money if I didn't see the need. So I'm just servicing the need. Cremation is on the rise. I'd say our cremation rate at the moment, and we're in rural Ireland, is about 25%. 15 years ago, that would be 1%. So that's the direction now. People's attitude has changed towards death and dying in Ireland. We still keep our own, you know, rituals and traditions, which are very important to us. But we have a choice now.
Can I leave this room now? Is that all right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. It's good if you're able to leave it.
Yeah. And we're off. So why are we heading in to the funeral home?
We're going to go into the funeral home in the Market Shed. Mm. And I was actually just given some ash. So I also do memorial keepsake jewellery. And there's a girl got on to me and she's getting married next month. And she wanted her dad's ashes to be in a piece of jewellery so he could walk her down the aisle.
Oh my God.
I know. It's gorgeous. Things you can do. So we'll go in there now anyway.
So Brigitte, we have the dream for the crematorium there and the plans. But a little bit about yourself. How do you handle it? Because you're a young, vibrant woman. Sometimes you come across, I'm sure, very sad situations.
Yeah, I get great job satisfaction from helping people through their grief. For all the work you do put in, like you could be up at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 in the morning, collecting the remains. But you have to look at it like that's somebody's special person. Do you know, you can't look at it like another number or else you wouldn't last in the job. Like, this is someone who is so important to somebody and I need to look after them so well. At the very beginning, I said to Dad, when I started doing it properly full time, I ended up having to go into the bathroom in the house sometimes, and when we were doing closing the coffin, because I was too emotional, it was too sad and I was crying and stuff. I said, Dad, I'm not able for this. And he said, no, the fact that you're crying shows that you care. And he said, that's the most important thing. He said, now you just need to learn how to focus and keep your focus on the job at hand, because there's a million things happening anyway. But for me, after the funeral, after the cremation or after the burial, it's that drive home from work that evening. If I've been really affected, I'll just find myself wailing and just letting it all out. And I think it's so important to do that, because otherwise it's just like a pressure cooker, you know. Or getting into the sea, like being by the sea. And for me as well, a big part of why I can do this is because I have music as an emotional outlet, and I can express things through my music
that I wouldn't necessarily be able to express other ways.
Yeah.
So we're here now.
Okay, perfect.
In Market Yard. Yes. And I'm going to bring you into the funeral home now.
Perfect.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to our funeral home.
So you grew up in a funeral home. Mm. What was that like? If you could.
We're going to go up to the coffin display area. And this is where me and my sister Mary actually would have had great fun growing up.
In a room with coffins.
So you've coffins everywhere you look.
Yeah.
They're all actually different, believe it or not. Yeah. But me and my sister, when we lived in the funeral home, we actually used to play hide and seek. And then these trolleys as well. We used to use them like go-karts. We used to go up and down the hallways, pushing each other up and down the hall. So, you know, we had a lovely childhood. It's not that it was very solemn, like, or anything, like living in a funeral home. Like,
no.
We kids will make fun wherever. And like, we didn't realise that that wasn't normal. And like, he often dropped us to school in the hearse. Now, that's when it started to get a bit embarrassing. So when you're a teenager being dropped off at school in a hearse and he'd go right up to the door.
And Brigitte, people know you for your music, and music informs everything you do here in the funeral home. We have your harp here because you play at funerals.
Yes, sometimes people ask me to play for a service, play a few tunes or a piece or whatever. And I love being able to do that for them. I love my music. My music is, it's my true love.
As we have the harp in front of us, would you mind performing for Countrywide?
I would love to. Thank Aww. You so much. I would actually love to play a song that I wrote for my granny, Bridie. It was actually about how my granddad lost her when she was only 50. I'd be very spiritual and I believe that they're together again now. And it's called Will We Meet Again? Will we meet again in the clouds and the stars? Or is that just a thought we think till we die? We don't have much time when you think of it too. But I love the time that I spent with you.
Brigitte's lucky that only she didn't know the lyrics. Brenda Donoghue would have been joining in there. More of her music on Insta at Brigitte Music. That's all we have time for on the programme team today. Cara O'Hare, Aina Dacour and Brenda Donoghue. Sinead Mooney on the way after the news at 9. Do not forget Ear to the Ground on Thursday evening on RTE1. And do have a great weekend. Take care.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.